Hello, and welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency, devoted to promoting musicians and authors worldwide. Call us today at 941-877-1552 to start your free publicity evaluation. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Please welcome the host of Interviewing the Legends, music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello once again, everyone. I'm your host, Ray Shasho, and welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends on BBS Radio, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or email us at publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Dennis Coffee is an American original. Only in America, and specifically only in Detroit, could one man play guitar with a group of legends as diverse as Del Shannon, The Temptations, George Clinton, and Funkadelic. However, the list of iconic artists, producers, and writers Dennis has worked with the world over only scratches the surface of what the man has done and the contributions he's made to the canon of popular music. Dennis Coffey first began to make his mark as a member of the Royal Tones, a group which had hits in the late 50s and early 60s, and who performed sessions with other artists, including Del Shannon. From there, Dennis moved on to a distinguished run as a session guitarist for various labels, operating at the peak of Detroit's influence as a hub of musical innovation and commercial success. He's perhaps best known for his work as a member of the legendary Funk Brothers, backing a veritable trunkload of hits from Motown, specifically The Temptations, classics Cloud Nine, Ball of Confusion, and Just My Imagination. It is in those works that his introductory of the wah-wah guitar sound to Motown first reared its head, and the resulting influence on all kinds of popular music continues to reverberate to this day. His work with The Temptations is just the tip of the iceberg, though he's on stuff like War by Edwin Starr, Band of Gold by Freda Payne, on and on as the list goes on. In the early 70s, Dennis struck out on his own as an artist film score producer. He scored the cult classic film Black Belt Jones. He recorded Scorpio in 1971 as part of his second solo record and first for Sussex Evolution. Scorpio was a million-selling single. It was a key foundational track in the history and development of hip-hop, totally apart from his status as a funk classic. Dennis is also featured in the 2002 film Standing in the Shadows of Motown, further combating his legacy as a key contributor to the development of some of the most cherished and important popular bands in the 20th century. So yeah, this man's important. This isn't just a history lesson, though. Dennis has continued to write and perform music. He's a lifer. Now it's time for a new chapter, an opportunity to both remind music fans what he's done and show them what's to come. Dennis is a cast member in the Sony film Searching for Sugar Man. He is also a co-producer and co-arranger, along with Mike Theodore, for some of the songs on the soundtrack. He also plays guitar and bass in some of those songs. Guitarist Dennis Coffey was that elite band of musicians who helped to create the Motown sound. Who said that? Edwin Starr. Please welcome legendary session guitarist, recording artist, producer, and author, Dennis Coffey, to Interviewing the Legends. Hello, Dennis.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing good, thank you. It's hard to get all your accomplishments in, you know?
I know. Well, someone's got to do it.
I can go on and on, but, you know, then I wouldn't need you.
That's right. That's true.
You know, I want to first talk about the Royal Tones. I think they were a very underrated band. They were awesome, man. Some of the songs on there, like, you know, Going Swimming, you know, which is a incredible track. That should have been a top 40 hit.
I know. Somewhere got lost in the shuffle.
And you know, the Yay Yay song, that did the Beatles steal that from you guys?
I don't think so, but you never know.
What a band. I was, you know, very intrigued. I got back into being a fan of the Royal Tones. You know, I saw the clip on Dick Clark's American Bandstand. I mean, so many great songs. A lot of instrumental tunes, but there were, you know, some vocal songs as well. So another song, If You Don't, kind of British Invasion R&B mix. I mean, these are the beginnings of so many, you know, great bands.
Yeah, Bob Babbitt was with me, and old funk brother Bob Babbitt, so right. He was the bass player with the Royal Tones also, so yeah, we were all doing that stuff.
What was it like back then in the beginning? I mean, this, you know, primarily was before the Beatles and the British Invasion and all that.
What was interesting is when the Beatles came over here later on in life, I played with Ringo Starr on his Goodnight Vienna album.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It was kind of interesting because, you know, playing at Motown, back in those days, Motown and the Beatles were going head-to-head. You know, the British Invasion, the only company that withstood that invasion as to where it was Motown. They were still always in the top ten.
I could hear a lot of the precursor, you know, to the Motown sound in songs like Our Faded Love. You know, I can see where it all started, you know?
Yes.
And the song Holy Smokes, which is a rocker, I mean, that sounds like Elvis's band later in life.
Yeah, I got a chance to do some stuff with James Burton. You know, I used him on a session in L.A., and then I played with him in London, and then I played with him down in Memphis for an event down there. Man, he's a great guy and, you know, great player, so, you know, we got to become a little bit friendly and stuff. That was very good. You know, I used to watch him on Ricky Nelson's show, so we're playing gigs together and stuff. It's pretty cool.
Did you meet Elvis?
I never did. I saw him live, but I didn't meet him. I saw him live at about 13, because I did meet Scotty Moore, the mm-hmm. guitar player that was with him. But I my mom took me to hear him when I was about 13, and the girls were screaming so loud you couldn't even hear the band. I was a little disappointed in that part of it.
What year was that? When in the 50s?
Yeah, that was probably about 13. That's so I was about 53, I think.
Oh, that was right in the beginning there then.
Yeah. And I was into all that rockabilly stuff. In fact, the first record session I did was a record called I'm Gone by Vic Gallen.
Mm-hmm.
You can go on YouTube. I was 15 when I was hired for that session, and you can hear me do two rockabilly solos on that record.
Man, you were way ahead of your time.
Well, that's the whole idea of it, you know. I have a short attention span, you know. So what I needed to do was always try and be ahead of things. And, you know, also when I got out of high school, I volunteered for the draft, and I was in the 101st Airborne Division.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, and Jimi Hendrix was down there about the same time as I was,
uh-huh.
And the guys in his unit hit his guitar on him and wouldn't give it back. He was real unhappy, but the guy who played rhythm guitar for me was a guy named Bob, and he had cut a guy up in a bar fight, so he was given the choice of join the airborne or go to prison.
Oh, my goodness.
He was my wingman, so I saw him knock a guy out in the chow line for just taking cuts in front of us, so nobody ever thought about hiding our guitars.
So you actually jumped out of airplanes?
I sure did.
How many jumps did you have? You remember?
Oh, probably only about seven, because what happened is in jump school for the first 2 weeks, you know, you jump about five times.
Right.
And later on, due to cost, you only can jump once every 3 months. So I stayed in that outfit for about a year, and basically we were just waiting around for a war to happen, and I got bored. So I transferred out of that and went down to Fort Jackson for the last year, and I was recording with Maurice Williams down there and a lot of different artists in Columbia, South Carolina. So I was that way. I was working the clubs and doing all that stuff, and still, you know, being in the Army.
Now this was this before Vietnam?
Yes. Yeah. And what was interesting is because I volunteered for the draft right out of high school, because I had 2 years, you know, and I figured that was my obligation, and I had 2 years without work because I was too young to work in the bars. So when I got out, of the airborne and the army and all that, I was still only 20, so I went in the bars anyway. So I'm working in the bars at 20 up here. You had to be 21. And the day before my 21st birthday, I looked at the front door and I recognized the vice cops coming in, just because after 2 years in the army, you get a little smarter, you know. So I dropped my wallet and put my foot on it because I saw them coming, and they come and wanted to see my ID, and I made a big deal looking for my wallet, even though it was under my foot. And then they said, well, we're coming back tomorrow. And if you're not 21, we're going to give you a ticket and a bar ticket and all that stuff. So the next day, I was going to be 21 after midnight. So I was watching the front door. I figured I was in good shape then, you know, after airborne training. If they came in, I'd ran out the back door. They'd never catch me. So they never did come in that day.
There's always some great Army stories, I'm telling you. So you were in there, what, 2 years in the Army?
Yeah, volunteered for the draft and went in and fulfilled my obligation. And then when I got out, once I became 21, I was, when I got out of the Army, I was out for 2 weeks, and then I joined the band 6 nights a week.
Wow. That's an incredible story. Did Hendricks, did he actually go to Vietnam? I think he did, didn't he?
I don't know if he did or not. I don't think he did.
Oh, he didn't make it to Vietnam. Huh.
I think when we were both in there, I think he was out before Vietnam, just like I was.
You know, I respected Hendricks, because when they asked him about Vietnam, he says, I'm not going to say if I'm for it or against it, but I understand it. You know, he didn't put it down or anything, and, you know, you kind of respect him because he was in the military, and he jumped out of planes, and there's all these guys that have never been in the military that, you know, put everything down, and they don't know what it's like, you know, they have no idea.
Well, you have an obligation, because freedom is not free, you
exactly.
know, that's the whole idea. So, and then if you're going airborne, you learn the difference. You know, the airborne guys don't play. I mean, that's where all the special forces guys come from and everything else, you know, so... I still go to meetings once a month with the special forces and airborne guys and everything, you know, that were in all this stuff. So it's kind of an interesting group.
It is.
You know, one guy, he's a Green Beret special forces guy, and on the back of his sweatshirt, it says, "I do bad things to bad people."
I like that. That's a tough cookie.
Yeah, you bet. That's for sure.
Well, thank you for your service. I want to say that first.
You're welcome.
Yeah, my I'm taking care of my dad. He's 94, and he's an ex-Marine from World War II, which is not too many of those guys left, you know?
Yeah, my dad was in the Navy in World War II.
Really? Is he still around, or did he pass away?
No, he passed away, but he was in the Navy in World War II. He lost half a lung when he got the U-boat sunk his ship in
England.
And also they shrunk one of his lungs when he finally, you know, recovered from that. But
really?
He was in the Navy.
Yeah, my father-in-law was in Germany. He passed away, but he was a point man in Germany in World War II.
Okay.
Yeah. I wouldn't want to be a point man. Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
So all I can say about the Royal Tones is they were way underrated. They kind of started things off for a lot of great bands in the future. I love listening to those songs. I really do.
Well, you know, we were working in bars 6 nights a week as the Royal Tones, and finally, after 3 years, I think people were getting a little tired of it, so we worked the Jersey Shore all summer. So that was pretty cool. But Summer's Point. So we worked that, and then after that, you know, we came back here, and the work wasn't here for us, that's when we kind of split up.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you worked with Del Shannon, right?
Yes. First worked with Del Shannon when we worked at Summer's Point. We drove down to New York City at Bell Sound and recorded with Del. You know, we did Handyman, we did Little Town Flirt, and a couple. He had some million sellers. The first million seller I played on was with Del Shannon.
Well, one of my favorite bands, and I'm still friends, I keep in touch with Peter Rivera, has always been Rare Earth.
Yes, yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And you were
Gil Bridges lives here in Detroit. I see him once in a while.
Oh, does he?
He bought the name from Pete.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I don't think.
And it's,
I think there's some bad blood there.
Gil found a singer, a drummer out of Lansing, that sounds quite a bit like Pete, was kind of surprising. You know, the guy can do all that stuff. But they're still on the road, as far as I know. I think Pete goes out with a different bunch of people.
Yeah, Pete. I've seen Pete a lot of times now, and he sounds the same, man. He sounds great.
Sure. Yeah.
I heard. Well, you were on their debut album, Dreams and Answers, and you produced that album.
Yeah, Mike Theodore and I did, and the guitar player got lost the first day of recording, so I had to play guitar on it because he somehow got lost and didn't show up for the session.
That was what, Rod Richards? Rod Richards,
yes,
I think, right?
It was.
Yeah. What kind of dog you got?
You know, it's my grand dog. It's my son's dog. She's a Basset and on a part Shar Pei.
Oh, wow.
She's barking at another dog across the street because she thinks she owns the neighborhood.
They all do.
That's right. That's what they do.
Well, you played a lot, too. I always have trouble. Is it Ray Manet? Is that how you pronounce it?
Ray Manet, yeah.
Oh, Manet, yeah. Ray is a great guitar player.
Yeah.
I met him a couple of times. Nice guy. And, you know, he was very important to that rare sound later, like after the 70s, you know?
Yeah, well, you know, Ray and I played when Holland Dozier and Holland started their own label, Hot Wax, and everything. Ray Manette and I played on those earlier sessions, and then when Ray was a member of Rare Earth, he wasn't available for the sessions, so Ray Parker Jr. Became the other session guy over there instead of Ray Manette later on.
Yeah, I think Ray picked up your wah-wah. He does a lot of that.
Yeah, he does, yeah. Good player.
Good player.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I want to talk about the, of course, the Funk Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I think of them, you know, they're so instrumental to the Motown sound. And you know, then there's that other group, the Wrecking Crew, who were very important to that top 40, you know, sound as well. Did you know some of those guys from the Wrecking Crew?
I think I did one session with Hal Blaine out there.
With Hal Blaine, who we just lost, yeah.
Yeah. But other than that, I was mainly doing sessions at Mo West, and, you know, I work with everybody out there. I work with Quincy Jones, and I work with Ringo Starr, and I work with Tom Jones, and a lot of different people out there. So when I was in L.A., I did the thing for about 3 years, and I got bored and came home.
Well, yeah, I'm a big Motown fan as well. I grew up in the D.C. area, you know, which was kind of a mini Detroit.
Okay.
You know, we grew up with...
We played at Constitution Hall down there, remember?
Yeah, Constitution Hall, you're right. Yeah, great place.
Yeah.
And I think you were telling, you're saying that Norman Whitfield and Marvin Gaye were probably the two most important people, right, to the Motown sound.
Well, Marvin Gaye was very important to Motown. Norman Whitfield was the one that, when he used me on Cloud Nine with that wah-wah pedal, that's what he was looking for. He was the guy that was moving Motown into the day of the protest songs and all those kind of things, where Motown had been doing all the relationship songs and so forth. So Norman was the one that, because he could see this whole Vietnam War thing, you know,
right,
the song War and all the other stuff I played on. You know, so Norman was the one that was taking Motown into current social protest. And then Marvin kind of, when he did the What's Going On, he kind of got involved in that. And then I did I Want You Back with Marvin. I did that whole album with him out in L.A. And Marvin, bless his soul, was smoking a joint the whole time. So what can I say?
Hey, I love Marvin Gaye, you know.
Yeah, he, very cool.
He was cool, you know. I read saw the story about him that, you know, when he got help, he went to, with a family, I think it was in Amsterdam or something, that he lived in. Yeah, he lived with a family, you know, in Amsterdam. The guy was a promoter, and they helped him, you know, because he was very much into drugs. But he came from that, and when he left, he that's when he started doing a comeback and had some great comeback hits. But he was also a good drummer, right? What I understand.
He was, but I never encountered him playing drums. You know, he was just you know, when I did the album with Ringo, Jim Keltner and Ringo were both playing drums on that thing.
Right. Yeah, Keltner's another good drummer.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And of course, you worked with Jamerson, which was an incredible bass player.
Oh yeah, he was my best friend at Motown, and that's how I got to Motown. Is I knew everybody was lined up for that those musical chairs at Motown, so I just ignored the whole thing and went about my business. And then they called me. You know, Jamerson called me up one day and said, "This is, you know," he saw me in the clubs a little bit, and he said, "You want to introduce me to Hank Cosby?" And Hank Cosby said, they put together a producer's workshop for the producers to experiment in the Golden World Studios, you know, upstairs. So four nights a week, they put me on a retainer, and it was Jamerson's band. And so we were in that workshop, and a couple months we were in there, and Norma Whitfield came in with a chart on a song called Cloud Nine and said he wanted to run it down, and I threw a wah-wah pedal on the front, and Norman said, "That's what I want." And within 2 weeks, I was playing it for the Temptations, and that was it. Norman had me all the time over there, and then everybody else started using me over there, too. And then at night, I would go work for Holland Dozier and Holland and do Frida Payne and Chairman of the Board and all that other stuff.
Well, that Frida Payne song, Band of Gold, I mean, how many times do we still hear that on the radio?
Yeah, and I had the Coral Electric sitar, and that was a written part, you know, that fit with everything.
Yeah.
That's kind of how that happened. At the same time, I was doing the dramatics, you know, In the Rain and What You See Is What You Get. And then I was going down to Muscle Shoals with Wilson Pickett doing Don't Knock My Love and all that other stuff. So it was fun. Times were busy.
How did that process work? I mean, you know, you invented a lot of the guitar licks, but how did you mix that in with the music? Was there music already established?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. At Motown, and mainly as a session musician, you have to be able to sight read. I mean, there was a lot of, you know, I remember Jay Graydon as a guitar player, producer out in L.A., he and I were studying sight reading from this conductor of the Palace Verdi Symphony just to get better at that. But at Motown, they gave us a master rhythm chart, which had all, you know, three stabs of the different parts on it. And our job first was to read the arrangement, because they had great arrangers. You know, Paul Reiser, I just saw him last week, and David Van Der Pit, and some of the arrangers at Motown had. So that was the first job. I mean, you walked in for a three-hour session. You walked in at 10 o'clock, and your job in that first, each hour, was mainly to read a chart of a song you never saw before, read the chart correctly, come up with a feel, and record one song an hour with no mistakes and make them a hit. That's
wow.
What we did.
Jeez. I give you guys a lot of credit, man. You guys are what made it all happen.
Well, I mean, the whole thing is that we got good at it because we did it every day. I was doing double sessions every day, and then
right.
I would do HTH at night and everything and all that stuff. So when you have a group of guys like the Funk Brothers, I mean, that was probably the greatest rhythm section I ever played with and was a part of for years. I mean, when you get guys like that, we were all friends and stuff, and you play together every day like that, you get real good at it.
Did you like working in the Motown studios?
Oh, yeah. We all had fun. I mean,
yeah.
We did our job. And like I said, we were friends, you know, so we had fun doing it. I mean, that was the whole thing. I mean, we were comfortable working with each other. And that was what people don't really understand is the Funk Brothers worked together as a team.
Right.
We learned teamwork. We made our jobs easier by working with each other. You had no showboaters. I mean, everybody, we came in and did the job, made the producer and arranger happy, and we played together. We, you know, the guitar section, we used to sit, me and Joe Messina and Eddie Willis and even Robert, we'd divide the guitar parts up to make it easier on ourselves, you know. That's what we did.
Yeah, I'm glad there wasn't any showboats. That would have made things a lot difficult.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, that was, you had to, it was the team, and what had made it interesting is that we all bounced feel off of each other. So you had 11 guys in there. If you made a mistake, they had to stop the tape.
Right.
And we did, you know, one song an hour with the 11 guys, and we kind of, that vibe. Nowadays, they do a computer and a drum track and one guy at a time. They're missing that synergy of 11 guys bouncing ideas and feel off of each other. That's what's missing nowadays unless they have a live band doing it.
You know, I don't care how much producing you do and mixing you do today to try to get the sound good. There's nothing like that original sound from those 45s, you know, back in the 50s and 60s.
Sure.
Very clean sound, you know. They can't copy that, you know. They really can't.
No. Well, that's again nowadays the operation as a keyboard guy to a drum track, and then everybody comes in one guy at a time. And I did a couple of those sessions, and the guy said, "You know, you guys must have had so much fun playing with everybody together at the same time. We don't get that.
Yeah,
you know, we overdub parts." And Steve Luker there, Toto, told me, he says, "I could do overdub a part 1,000 times if I want, because we can do it. You guys had to do it all at once." And at the same time, with no mistakes, and do one song an hour. He says, "I really respect that."
Yeah, today, they, when they make an album, you know, they get all the artists to send MP3s, you know, email them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's what happened. On the last album I did, I had some different singers on it, and they just sent it on the internet over there to wherever they lived, and they overdubbed their part and sent it back.
That's no fun.
Yeah, it just wasn't. It wasn't to me.
You know, one of the most influential songs, you're talking about, protest songs and this and that, whatever, Edwin Starr's War. And,
oh, yeah.
I mean, that lives on and could, you know, every generation, it just fits in. I loved Edwin Starr, man. He was incredible.
Oh, he was a great guy. I got a chance to, I was doing a book tour overseas.
Right.
And my publisher knew Edwin. So Edwin was living over in the UK by then. And, we went to hear, he was doing live shows. So we went to hear one of his live shows with he had about a 11-piece band and everything. And I got to hang around with him, for about an hour, you know, before the show.
Right.
And I had worked with Edwin at Golden World. So I knew him from there, you know. Then I got a chance to see him over in the UK. He was just such a great singer. What a nice guy. Very cool.
So talk about making, doing the War session. What was that like?
Well, you know, that was just a typical, the Funk Brothers, and
uh-huh.
Norman was the guy. You know, Norman Whitfield was always a master of dynamics. You know, he'd always be breaking it down.
And yeah.
He'd be always standing in front of Uriel and Pistol, the drummers. That's where he stood. He was never in the control room.
Huh.
Norman, when we did the rhythm tracks, he's always in front of the drummers, and he'd be doing breakdowns, you know. Well, everybody stop, and I just want to hear a hi-hat over here, and I'll cue you in and all that. That's what his whole, one of his great skills was, a master of dynamics, Norman Whitfield
right.
was.
Yeah, we need more guys like that today. I mean, that's, we're missing.
Oh, yeah. Well, we need more budgets. We need going to studio. And the last album I did on myself, I did it with everybody. I don't never do the way that everybody else does. I don't do that.
Yeah.
I go in and do an album. I'll bring the whole band in together, and we'll do the album. We'll do the solos and everything. We don't overdub and do that. Because at Motown, I never overdubbed a Ball of Confusion.
Right.
Trolls, just by, we didn't overdub anything. We just cut that stuff right with the tracks and go.
Yeah. Yeah, I talked to Billy Cobham once in a while. We were talking about the Spectrum album.
Okay.
You know, that was loose. You know, they did that really quick, and, you know, they had a few mistakes in there. They left them in, and they had a good time, and it was a great album.
Yeah, I mean, you have to look at the feel, you know. There might be a few blemishes, I call them, but not, if you have a real outright glaring clinker of the wrong chords that really doesn't fit in it, you know, but generally if it's a minor issue, as long as you got the feel, it's better. I mean, the feel is what it's about, not about whether you have a minor mistake or not.
Yeah, today everything's overproduced, you know, and it's just,
sure.
it's a totally different scene today. I'm not happy with it. I was a top 40 DJ also back in the late 70s, and, you know, I've seen a lot of changes. And
I mean, nowadays the producer's the ruler, and he plays keyboards usually,
yeah.
And he writes all the material and all this kind of crap, you know, instead of having a live band go in there and really, you know, really deliver on that level. But sometimes I think the keyboardist producers get carried away with what they want.
Right.
They want to do the click track and all the other stuff, which just kind of makes the stuff, I think, very stilted.
You know, I there's an interview with Frank Zappa on YouTube, which I love. He was talking about, you know, because his music was very innovative, and, you know, a lot of stuff what didn't make it to the radio. And he was saying the guys that took a chance on music were those cigar chomping guys, old guys that didn't know anything about it, but they let's take a chance, you know. And the guys that were, he was fearful of, were the young guys that thought they knew everything. Because they thought they knew everything, they wouldn't play anything they didn't like, and that's, he was right about that.
Well, that was the whole thing, you know. I had one time somebody on us doing a session in L.A. wrote on the chart, play this like David T. Walker. I said, why the hell did you call David? Was he busy? I don't play like David T. You want David T. sound like David T.
Exactly.
Don't tell me like play like him.
Exactly right. You also did, you worked with another group, which was not Motown, the band Gallery, which I remember.
Yes.
Nice to Be With You was a big hit, and you worked with them as well.
Yeah, me and Mike Theater, we kind of applied that. We were going to put that group out with Clarence, and they wouldn't let him put out any pop music, and we kind of stuck it in anyway. And Buddha got mad at us and him, too, because we had a big pop hit, and Buddha told Clarence, we didn't hire you to do pop music. That's what we do. But before they knew it, we had a smash hit with the Gallery.
That's amazing. You know, that's totally different. You're doing a 180 there. Huh. And, of course, you did Black Belt Jones. You did that.
Yep.
The score for that. I don't know. Why didn't Curtis Mayfield or Isaac Hayes call you, you know, for Shaft and... what's the Curtis Mayfield? He did, it's got Freddy's Dead on it, and,
I saw Curtis, I opened up for him in, Philharmonic in New York, you know, so he's really a great guy,
loved
what he was doing, but then, you know, Theodore and I discovered Rodriguez and got that whole thing going, so you had a whole nother deal happening with him. I mean, we knew it would be a hit, but it took the public in a movie 30 years later, 40 years later to catch up with Rodriguez.
Yeah, that's true. That's an interesting story. I saw the movie.
Yeah. So, and I opened up for Rodriguez in London and Manchester about 4 years ago. You know, I opened up and played with the band there.
So what's he doing now?
You know what? I don't really, I'm not sure what he's doing. Rodriguez is kind of, he's always been, you know, every time Mike Theodore and I would hook up with him, he'd say, well, I'll meet you on the street corner over here by the beer store or something. He'd be wandering around the neighborhood at Wayne State with a wine flask on his back. That's
really
how we held our meetings with Rodriguez.
Very secretive guy, huh?
Yeah. He was always that way.
You were on his first album, right? Cold Fact?
We discovered him. Me and my sister got him a deal. And when we first saw him at the sewer by the river there in Detroit, he was singing and facing the wall. we're looking at the back of his head saying, who is this guy? You know,
that's
so
weird.
We listened, but that, you know, it kind of forced you to listen to the songs. But that's how he performed in those days. He faced the wall.
Huh. That's crazy. Yeah, he's a different guy.
and we couldn't get him in the studio. He was so shy that we brought him in the studio by himself and recorded four songs, the first four, and we built the band around him after he left.
Huh.
And then we got him used to coming in the studio with the musicians. But that first four songs, he wouldn't do it. So we brought him in by himself and recorded him and his guitar. And then we brought the musicians in later and kind of built them around the track.
That's interesting. Very interesting guy. Yeah. You wrote a book, which I wish I had. I'm gonna go out and buy it. Guitars, Bars, and Motown Superstars.
Correct.
Do you have some great stories in there?
Oh, yeah. You know, and I tried to not overanalyze it, and I tried as a writer
right.
to make it entertaining, not, you know, and I got so tired of people writing books about music that weren't there.
Right.
And so because they weren't there, they're relying on the biases and opinions of others who were. So I always felt that I'm going to tell my story because I was there, and I'm going to write a book to do it, and I could, and I did. I didn't have a ghostwriter. I mean, I can write, you know. So I wrote many training manuals and everything, so I know how to write.
Yeah, I'm an author, too, and I respect that, you know, because there's so many bestsellers that, I like to write, you know, and they haven't done anything. It's all ghostwriters.
No. And I made it a positive book, and somebody from L.A. says, where's all the dirt? I'm not about writing about dirt.
I know.
I know a lot about that stuff. Well, sure, you can find that in anything, but that's not what it's about. Music is a positive, and I'm a positive guy. I don't believe writing about crap just to sell books. That'd be absurd.
Amen, brother. I do thousands of interviews, and I don't do any dirt at all. It's all about the music.
You can always find dirt on anybody. We're all human. But you know, if you're looking at a positive accomplishment of being successful in the music business, why would you want to show the dark side
right.
of everybody? Everybody's got one. Why don't you just show the positive things that tie into their accomplishments and let's celebrate, you know, what they've done.
You know, music gets people through life, you know. Music,
yes.
People timeline their life with music. I do
yeah.
all the time, you
yeah.
know.
Yeah, and what I do is, I know I used to, for 1 year straight, I was in three songs in Billboard in the top 10
right.
and 10 songs in the top 100 for a year straight.
Well, I remember when Scorpio came out. It was awesome, you know. Everybody loved that song.
I remember I was playing in Brooklyn in a hotel. It was a 20,000. They had a 2,000 crowd in a big hall upstairs of the hotel. And we started, we you know, played some of our songs, you know, and then I started going into Scorpio, and I looked up, and there was a conga line of 2,000 people booking towards the bandstand. I said, oh, no, what's this?
Things get big very fast when you
yeah,
have a hit
yeah.
record.
That sure can. Yeah.
Did you have, was Bob Babbitt on bass on that track, on
yeah.
that song?
Yeah, he was, you know, and I let him take that bass solo helped
yeah.
him that record. It was such a tremendous bass solo, which you never heard bass solos, you know, so he just took off and did his thing.
How'd you come up with that song? What was
you know what, I had a bunch of songs. When I did it, I was sitting in the basement with my Sound On Sound tape recorder, and
right.
I was doing a guitar band thing, so I wrote 10 songs. Did the guitar band thing, overdubs, just to show Mike Theater what I was talking about, and he convinced Clarence to come up with the budget. So that's where that song came from, and I never named my songs, I just put numbers on them, and then when I get them done, I name them.
So how'd you come up with the name?
Well, I don't know, I'm a Scorpio, so I
think, oh, there you go.
Yeah.
I always think of the movie when I think of it, you know?
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
That song hit, I think it hit number 6 on Billboard Hot 100, and it hit number 9 on the soul charts.
Yeah, well. Yeah, it was a gold record. That was my first gold record.
I was listening to, you did a, the Isley Brothers, It's My Thing instrumental
right.
on YouTube, which was incredible.
The Isleys also, Skip Pitts was the guy who played on the original.
Right.
And I got to know Skip Pitts when he came up here and played. And so we did, like, dueling wah-wahs at the House of Blues in New Orleans, me and Skip. It was crazy. We had a great time.
Yeah, the Isley, they're still around. They did an album with Santana, which was cool.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, the 70s were a great time for funk and R&B. And
sure was.
It was incredible, man. And
yep.
And, I mean, you had, like, bands like the Ohio Players, Earth, Wind & Fire, Kool & the Gang, the Commodores.
Yeah.
You know, did you get involved a little bit with the 70s bands as well, or?
No, you know, well, I stayed in Detroit. I lived in L.A. for 3 years, 73 to 76, so I worked with some different people out there. But generally, you know, I've pretty much... I'm in Detroit, and Detroit is what it is right now, and it's,
yep.
There's music everywhere in Detroit all the time.
Always been.
You know, so that's my connectivity to the people, and I play every Tuesday night. I've been at the same place for 11 years. It's 2 miles away from the Motown Museum. I'm at Northern Lights Lounge, so in my career, I've come 2 miles, so I'm happy. That's all right. It works.
Yeah, oh yeah, that sounds like a great gig, man.
Oh yeah, super.
Another big guy, James Brown, and I love Sly and the Family Stone. So it's a shame what happened to Sly. Did you know James Brown at all?
Never met any of those guys. I worked with Wilson Pickett. He was the only one of those guys that I worked with.
There is nobody like Wilson Pickett, man.
He was the guy.
He had that scream. Nobody could do
that. He did. He was the real deal, Wilson was.
He was the real deal. I loved
yep.
Wilson Pickett. Well, you got a new album out, right? Live at Baker's?
Live at Baker's, and I got one following it
already
next week.
You're kidding me.
It's called Down by the River. It's on Mac Avenue's Detroit Music Factory. That's coming out next week.
Oh, really? Wow, that was quick.
Oh, hey, You know, I'm happy. Two albums within 1 month. That works for me.
Unbelievable. Well, I love Live at Baker's, man. I gave it 5 stars.
Well, excellent. Appreciate that.
It's got Scorpio on it. It's got covers of Miles Davis, The Temptations, Jimmy Smith, you know?
People don't realize that, you know, I was playing jazz back in the day with Lyman Woodard and Melvin Davis.
That's
I used to hang out with Wes Montgomery all the time when he came into town. So I was Wes was my guitar idol as far as jazz goes. And George Benson's great too, all these guys. So, I, you know, studied the jazz guitarists, all of them, Barney Keswell, all those guys. So they were the forerunners of the jazz guitar, which is very cool.
Well, I love the album, man. Just My Imagination, to me, is one of those licks that I remember, you know, as from Motown. To me, the number one.
Yeah, I created that lick on the fly in the intro. I just made it up on the spot.
And yeah.
That's like My Girl, you know, that lick.
Exactly.
Everybody knows that. And when I play it in the club and say I did this, they can hear that it's me.
Yeah.
They can hear it because I play it just like I did it on the record.
That's so cool. How cool is that? And you got All Blues Live. It kind of reminded me a little bit of Jeff Beck, you know, the style.
Okay.
Yeah, and you showed off a lot on Dink's Blues. That was you showing off, right?
Yeah, you just go do what you do, and then tomorrow is another day and another musical moment, you know?
Everyone's got to listen to Dink's Blues on the album. It's incredible.
That's good.
Yeah, incredible. Well, I love the album, man. It's awesome. When is the next one coming out again?
Probably next week.
Next week? Wow.
Yeah.
Jeez. Well, we'll make sure we promote that one, too, and put it
on
all the websites.
Down by the River, it's on Detroit Music Factory, which is under Mac Avenue Records.
And is that a live album?
No. It's live in the studio, but not in the club. But I'm an artist now signed to Mac Avenue Records, so I'll do one album a year for them. I'll be doing one album a year, so I got to get busy and record another one.
Oh, great. Well, they're demanding, huh?
Yeah, there you go.
Just like the old days.
That's it, man. Gigs. I'm a pain to do music. Wow. That's creative.
You were inducted into the Michigan Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Congratulations on that.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, so many great artists from Michigan, man. I always say that the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame should have been in Michigan, not Ohio.
I always thought that myself, but I'm surprised how they let it be in Cleveland.
Yeah, I don't get that. You know, everything happened in Michigan.
Yeah, but they got the Motown Museum here that's expanding as we speak.
That's cool. Yeah, I want to come.
I donated a 335 Gibson guitar to them.
Did you really? Oh, man.
Yeah, so they've got that. I set it up and everything right where I used to sit.
That was your favorite guitar, wasn't it?
No. My favorite guitar is the Firebird that I use in all the sessions, and the 345 I use in the sessions I still have, though.
Right. You were on a show on PBS, History Detectives?
Yeah, me and James Jamerson Jr., I think, about an amplifier.
It was
his dad's.
Was it his dad's, I guess?
Well, he claimed it was, and I thought it was, and later they claimed it wasn't, so I don't know.
They never thought
it was at the time, and, you know, Jr. should know if it's his dad's amp.
Right, you would think so.
Yeah.
Well, Dennis, here's a question I ask everybody, and I get some interesting answers. If you had a Field of Dreams wish, like the movie, to perform or collaborate with anyone from the past or present, who would that be? And you work with so many people.
You know what? I pretty much, there's nobody that just why I have to work with that person, because I've worked with pretty much everybody. I mean, who haven't I worked with, actually? I mean, there's a few people, you know, but I played in Europe and Paris and Barcelona, Spain, and I've been in Germany, and all, you know, stuff like that. So I really don't know, you know, and then because you don't, I don't know. The phone rings and someone wants to work with me, you know.
That's true.
Well, it's not over yet.
It's not over yet. Yeah, you're still a young guy.
I am.
Yeah, there's a lot of guys still touring in their 80s, you know.
Well, touring to me got to be a pain, you know. I toured a lot in 2011. To support an album with Strut Records, which is based in London.
Right.
But after that, you know, I don't need a tour anymore.
Yeah. It takes a lot out of you. It really does.
It does. Yeah, it does.
So is there anything in your life you would have done differently?
I mean, you learn from experience and from your mistakes. One thing I probably would have done if I had time was I would have got my college degree when I was at Wayne. Instead, I had to go back later and get my bachelor's and master's, but I think I would have tried to finish the degree when I was there.
Mm-hmm.
But I just ran out of time because I was so busy with music. But I went back later and got it.
Oh, you did?
Oh, yeah. I got a master's and a bachelor's degree.
Ah, congratulations. Yeah, I wish I had done that, too, as well. I didn't, but I had a broadcasting... I went to, like, a technical school that was owned, actually, by CBS. So I learned radio and television there.
Okay.
Yeah. And they you know what I liked about them? They had a job placement, so they would get you started right away.
That's good.
Which was cool.
Good.
So do you know any of the guys, the legends in Michigan? That you know who I had on the show recently before you is Don Brewer from Grand Funk.
Yeah, I don't know him that well.
You got Alice Cooper. You got I interviewed Susie Quattro. I know Susie a couple of times.
None of those guys.
None of those guys. Yeah, they're later, I guess.
Well, I was a Motown guy.
You're all Motown. You know why? My dad had a store on F Street in D.C., and we met a lot of guys. He had drinks with Al Green. I sold a pair of binoculars to Luther Ingram, which was cool.
Okay.
Back in his day, he was a cool guy, and I did meet. Yeah. I met the Temptations later in life because they stayed. They did a lot of benefits in D.C. and everything. And
okay.
They were incredible. My favorites were always the Temps and the Four Tops.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yep. Mine too.
Yeah. Dennis, anything else you want to promote or chat about?
Just that's it. I got to run out of here and go on an appointment here, but I think we've covered pretty much everything that I could think of. The new CDs coming out of my book.
You got Live at Baker's, which is out. You got the, I'm going to promote the book. And another album, One Night at Maury's, was released not that long ago either.
That was out last year.
Last year, that was that's a great album.
Yeah, and also Northern Lights Lounge in Midtown Detroit.
Okay, awesome. Dennis, thank you so much, man, for being on the show today.
Okay.
Keep up the good work. You're a legend. And, you know, we'll touch bases again with you.
All right, good. All right, thanks.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye now.
Goodbye.
For more information about Dennis Coffee, please visit www.denniscoffeesite.com. Purchase the most recent release from Dennis Coffee, Live at Baker's, by Dennis, at Amazon.com. Also, last year he released One Night at Maury's, another incredible album from 1968, which you can also purchase at Amazon.com. From rock and roll kid to honorary member of Motown's elite rhythm section, the Funk Brothers, Dennis Coffey was one of Detroit's most in-demand session guitarists. After leaving Motown, Coffey became a regular at Hitsville, USA, playing on records for Marvin Gaye, The Supremes, Stevie Wonder, Gladys Knight, and Junior Walker. Most recently appeared in the documentary Standing in the Shadows of Motown. You can purchase this incredible journey, a book by Dennis Coffey entitled Guitars, Bars, and Motown Superstars, also available at Amazon.com. Very special thanks to the dynamic duo of Doug and Don Newsome of VBS Radio for making the magic happen for each and every broadcast of Interviewing the Legends. If you have comments or suggestions for the show, please contact me at interviewingthelegends@gmail.com. Please subscribe to my YouTube channel, Interviewing the Legends with Ray Shasho, for the very latest interviews. It's real news, people. Have a great week!
Thank you, everybody, for listening to Interviewing the Legends. Brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at PublicityWorksAgency.com, specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Tune in to Interviewing the Legends every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time on VBS Radio, Station 1.